The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the September issue of Our State Magazine, featuring articles around this month's theme of the sounds of home. Our first article is Run Straight, Run Loud. For nearly 70 years, a racetrack in Cleveland County has rumbled with the thunder of drag racing and one man's love of speed, family, and red clay. And on this, we have a picture here on the front page of the article. And the caption is, the growl and roar of race cars like Chase Howard's 67 Chevy Chevelle shake the hills surrounding Shadyside Dragway. And we have a crowd of people in the background, and then this red, white, and blue painted Chevy Chevelle from 1967. Ronnie Buff always has the best seat in the house, and he always will. On a hillside located 11 miles southwest of Shelby and only a few minutes above the South Carolina state line, that is if you adhere to the speed limit, sits a simple gray stone cemetery bench engraved with bold lettering that reads simply, Buff. The seat is fenced off and adorned with a pile of flowers that are replenished every weekend. As the sun begins to settle into this valley that sits at the very beginning of North Carolina's western rise into the Appalachians, it throws a bright yellow tinge onto the trickling waters of a bordering creek. A cardinal sings. You can hear the bustle and laughter of parishioners gathered beneath the steeple of Flint Hill Baptist Church in the distance. It's all so peaceful, until it isn't. A voice crackles over the loudspeakers that are mounted throughout the valley. The lanes are open for all classes. Just bring them on down. Suddenly, from behind those folds of all those hills, in that once sleepy holler, emerges machinery, golf carts and puttering scooters, pickup trucks, pulling trailers, and race cars. So many race cars. They're painted silver and orange and purple and... does that one have an angry shark plastered on its rear fender? And is that one called Chick Magnet and Bad Alibi and Loose Cannon? With a boom and a squeal and the high-tane octane groan of run, all those flowers that were resting in the ground around Ronnie Buff's best seat in the house are sent to rustling. The birds in the trees above the creek are startled into flight. And those churchgoers, well, okay, they don't even turn around. They just smile. After nearly seven decades, they're used to the ruckus. They love it, just as they loved Ronnie. Welcome to Shadyside Dragway, a living, fire-breathing throwback testimony to North Carolina's red clay auto racing roots and to the drag racing dreams of a man who still oversees the family business even now, 7 years after his death at the age of 68. Grandpa got this place in 1980, and I was born in 1991, so I've spent my whole life right here, explained Seth Buff, the oldest of the three boys known around here as Ronnie's grandbabies, followed by Zach and Bryson. Everyone you see working or racing is family. Everything we do is with Grandpa's spirit. The only thing he loved more than hard work was racing. Whenever people discuss motorsports in the old North State, the conversation immediately turns to NASCAR, and that's fair. Its torrid tale is taught to us by everyone from our North Carolina history teachers to Talladega Nights. Moonshine runners setting up their "my ride is faster than yours" arguments on the Carolina ovals where stock car racing was born. The reality is that those bull rings made up only half of stock car racing's creation. The path to the other side of that story, the shady side, is a very straight line. Everyone knows Daddy and all those guys he started with because of what they did on racetracks, recalls Richard Petty, the seven-time NASCAR champion and son of three-time champ Lee Petty. But I remember as a kid seeing guys racing side by side on the roads all around our house in Level Cross. That's drag racing. And a lot more people did that because racetracks are hard to find. Anybody could get on a road. These road racers started plowing clandestine dirt runways through any flat plot of land they could find that was also protected by a natural hill-bracketed hiding spot. When drag racing culture roared into the American mainstream in the 50s and 60s, set to the tune of the Beach Boys and immortalized in the silver screen, on the silver screen by the likes of Elvis and James Dean, drag strips began operating out in the open. In North Carolina, racers would tow their rides from Wednesday nights in Monroe to Friday nights in Kinston to Saturday evenings in Rockingham or Wilkesboro. Some events were officially sanctioned by the National Hot Rod Association, also known as the NHRA, or some other alphabet soup sampling of governing bodies. But most policed themselves. Welcome to all comers. They were called outlaw tracks. Shadyside was then and is now the realm of the outlaws. On this weekend, it's playing host to the Southeast Gassers Association, a traveling nitro circus with the stated goal of bringing back the authentic drag racing experience from the 1960s and creating an enjoyable atmosphere for the entire family. It's true, all the way down to the go-go boots worn by the women who help guide every machine into its lane. A real-life American graffiti, only much, much faster. There are places where you kind of have to dress up the place to fit the 1960s vibe, says Steve Spiney Davis of Monroe, driver of the 1962 Ford Falcon known as Spiney 3. Not Shadyside. This place is a time machine. In 1958, brothers Marshall and Travis Hamrick gathered up their tractors and graded out an eighth of a mile dragway in the malleable but solidly slick clay on the banks of a broad river branch known as Yancey Creek. Their track was never sanctioned, and they didn't intend to seek any fancy letters to hang over the gate. Outlaws they were, and an outlaw facility they would be. Soon after it opened, a local named Garland Buff towed his 1948 Austin A40 into Shadyside to see what his British midsize might do when unleashed upon the hills of Cleveland County. Riding shotgun in this 57 Chevy Bel Air wagon that towed the Austin was Garland's 10-year-old son, Ronnie. The kid was mesmerized. Only 2 years later, he was allowed to make a pass down Shadyside in the wagon. As an adult, Ronnie brought his new wife, Gail, to the track because he was romantic like that. Soon they were bringing their own son, Lenny. He, too, fell in love with the place. By 1980, the urban sprawl of the Piedmont had devoured most of the fabled North Carolina outlaw drag strips. Cul-de-sacs don't much care for all that high-powered horsepower hullabaloo. That's when Ronnie told the Hamricks that he wanted to buy Shadyside. They agreed, and Ronnie went to work updating the place. He and Gail hauled out truckloads of glass bottles that had been tossed into the dirt over the past 22 years. Eventually, they moved onto the property permanently. Lenny and grandfather Garland helped install the facility's first real timing system. Ronnie repaved the track and installed guardrails where there had been stacks of old race tires. He widened the racing surface from a very narrow 22 feet to a downright Broadway-feeling 51. And he straightened out Shadyside's greatest detriment, quite literally. For 50 years, racers had to let off the throttle early because just past the finish line, the track took a sharp left-hand turn, too cramped by the hills around it for a proper runoff area. In 2008, Ronnie pushed those hills back. The result? Shadyside's first ever 200 miles per hour run. People still talk about the tears in Ronnie's eyes when he witnessed that dash. What's so great to me about Shadyside is that Ronnie and his family update it, but it still feels like it should, said the man who made that 200-mile-per-hour run, Todd King Tut, Tutterow, a North Carolina-born speed legend with 19 championships throughout the drag racing world. You go there, and it's a classic. There's nothing but real racers at Shadyside. Now, just like his grandfather and father before him, Lenny and the full-grown grandbaby spend every weekend not named Christmas, making sure that their guests, racers and racing fans alike, receive the best old-school outlaw drag racing experience possible. At any given moment, the Buff Boys, their spouses, and their extended family of friends and volunteers are in perpetual motion at the wheel of the tractor that scrubs the racing surface. Behind the counter of the concession stand, wrapping hot dogs. Beneath the grandstand, applying one more coat of Rust-Oleum. All of the above rattled every few minutes by the click and bang of engine ignitions, the creaks of physics-defying metal, the shriek of burnouts, all building toward that loveliest noise of all, the symphony of Shadyside. The release of hammer-down passes like from the likes of Quick Draw, Odd Rod, and the Junkyard Dino, each roaring their way along that eighth of a mile, their drivers looking up to their right at the scoreboard to see how fast they went, and then looking up to their left to pay tribute to the best seat in the house. Ronnie Buff's perfect final resting place points toward the starting line per his instructions when he raced off this mortal coil, carried there via one last ride down the strip in a 1936 Plymouth hearse. Yeah, that's how Grandpa wanted it to be. He wanted to be where he could see those cars out there running Shadyside, Seth says. He was also always keeping an eye on all of us, and we wouldn't want it any other way. Shadyside Dragway is located on Honey Haven Farm Road in Shelby, North Carolina, and they have a website you could check out, shadysidedragway.net. Our next read is A Joyful Noise. In a century-old sanctuary in Kinston, an organist fills the air with music that sounds, from pulpit to pew, reverent, radiant, and rooted in tradition. Wyle Sawyer always has just a few concert jitters when we collect in the parlor. Having played alongside Sawyer since I was 13, this gathering has become a bit of a ritual. He takes a seat next to the cellist and crosses his legs, his foot shaking with nerves. He wears concert black, including a new button-up shirt that his wife Tara picked out. The shirt doesn't have to be tucked, which is good for Sawyer. Every bit the artist, he often falls victim to misplaced sheet music or untucked shirt tails. He and I crack jokes, and he always gets the most tickled, his gentle nature never succumbing to the pressure. Following the initial bow, Sawyer climbs the bench and begins gently tapping the keys. The organ sits on the sanctuary floor of Gordon Street Christian Church in Kinston, the church Sawyer and I attend and perform. As he presses a key, a signal travels to a pipe above, and a mechanism called a bellows pushes air through it. From their perch above the pulpit, the pipes exhale, yip, or belt. Wyle pushes the tonal landscape outwards, filling the open air of our 110-year-old sanctuary. At the keys is a place that has always felt comfortable to Sawyer, having sounded out melodies before he learned to sound out words. He was just 10 years old when he first played for a church service at Salem United Methodist Church in his hometown of Goldsboro. "My granddaddy took me because my parents were tied up," he tells me. "I'll never forget that old country church." Sawyer's parents were both organists and had started him with piano lessons when he was 3. By 2000, Sawyer had received his high school diploma along with a few national and international titles from the National Guild of Piano Teachers of the American College of Musicians. He went on to pursue an organ performance degree at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, but by his graduation in 2004, he had developed a calling beyond performance. "I wanted to give back to my community what I'd been given," he says. So he earned a master's in organ performance from East Carolina University in 2008, along with his teacher license, before settling back down in Lenoir County. On weekdays, he works in the school system. On weekends, he's at the organ, whether accompanying hymns or performing sonatas in our afternoon concerts. Keys, pedals, buttons, and pipes are Sawyer's tools for creating his church's soundscape. When he sits at the organ, 3 tiers of keyboards ascend in front of him. Each keyboard, called a manual, commands a division of pipes, the choir, the great, and the swell. Stops line up to Sawyer's left and right, each knob-like mechanism containing an electronic sound. Sawyer can select a horn for fanfare or a bell to chime the hour, whatever embellishment is needed. The choir, great and swell, each have their own register and distinct character. A composer may call for the musician to use one or lay them together, but like using switch-like couplers. But much is left to the organist's interpretation, painting the soundscape for milestones and celebrations. I like to use a wide variety of sounds, Sawyer says. Part of the artistry is registration, or how I orchestrate the sounds. For the doxology on Easter morning, Sawyer may choose the joy and reverence of the great. For a funeral meditation, the choir's lushness may feel more appropriate. At Sawyer's hands live the voice of sorrow and the triumph of celebration. While the organ has maintained its majesty through the ages, Sawyer feels organists are fighting for the instrument's relevance in the modern church and concert hall. Having had a natural connection to the organ, he hopes to create that feeling for others. A lot of times, the organ is misunderstood. It is a very musical instrument, he says. It can be expressive, the softest of the soft, the loudest of the loud. It can connect and invoke feelings of joy, melancholy, solemnity. Even as the organ's favor wanes, Sawyer stands steadfast at its helm. He says our congregation's support is what keeps him coming back each Sunday. With its arched ceilings and burgundy carpet, Gordon Street may be old and traditional, but it has a buoyant spirit and the same openness to the arts that first drew Sawyer in. In traditional churches like ours, a bell chimes hour to end the service. A bell chimes the hour to end the service and begin the postlude. Folks turned to catch up with neighbors while others herd family toward the door. This was our routine as well until Sawyer arrived in 2013. Early on, when the noon sun saturated the stained glass and the bell chimed the hour, the postlude began, and the congregation began their routine. Then Sawyer put his hands to the keys. He drew melodies out of the great, plucked motifs from the swell. He danced on each manual, then layered them so. Pulling bells and horn stops, he never dwelt in one place for long. As whole fanfares erupted at his feet, his glasses barely clung to the tip of his nose. We watched, his soft nature eclipsed by an uninhibited celebration, his own joyful noise. He sounded the final chords and let go, the air still. That Sunday, my church broke tradition, ending the service with great applause. I remember thinking, so that's the organ. Sawyer dismounted the bench, faced us, seemingly tickled. It appeared the jitters had returned, but he was beaming. If you'd like to go and hear him, he plays at Gordon Street Christian Church, which is on Gordon Street in Kinston, and they have a website, gordonstreetchurch.com. Next up is an eternal refrain. The song of our state has no final note. One writer knows that some of the sounds that make up its symphony live forever, belonging always and only to North Carolina. And the photo here is of Crabtree Falls. Cascades like Crabtree Falls, located near milepost 339.5 on the Blue Ridge Parkway, play a ceaseless soundtrack for those who venture to find it. And it's, of course, lots of greenery. There's a woman at the base of the falls looking up at the falls, which are cascading over stones, and the water, it churned up as it is and oxygenated, is white. And there's fallen trees and other rocks at the base of this waterfall. On the next page, we have the spectacular three-tiered Linville Falls in Burke County, which is one of the most photographed waterfalls in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And it's coming out of the rock formation there from a lake that's from within the rock formation, spilling out into a reservoir, it looks like, surrounded in almost like a stone quarry with an opening in the water, stones surrounded on every side. And it's taken place, the picture's in the fall, so we have a golden and a little bit of red and orange foliage. Mountain Melody. Where mountain winds leave off, highland waters may pick up with their own sounds and songs, unhurried burblings and tricklings. From nearly noiseless creek in the woods, it suddenly becomes the gushing, fast-sliding, showering stream of the 250-foot Cascades in Wilkes County to the huge, throaty resonance of Big Linville Falls pouring thickly forth from its plunge pool 90 feet below. Into its plunge pool 90 feet below, and well south to the hundreds of Transylvania County falls, each with a granite-bowled pool of their own, and the brisk, endless plashings into them all. The river that runs through much of this county, the French Broad, was known as the Longman to the Cherokee, who called all its tributaries his chattering children. No one who ever gets near any of these everlasting, hard-working, high country waters can fail to be charmed, even hypnotized, by our mountains' abiding and far, far older than time, watery sounds. They live forever on the land. They live always in our hearts. Summit Song. The high hills wind has no home, and it will do what it must, whether it's a shushing breeze easing over Cherokee's Kuwahi, or the banshee shrieking of Helene's 106-mile-per-hour hurricane force against Mount Mitchell last fall. Folks say that when the hard winds blow over Grandfather Mountain, they hit the steel planks of its swinging bridge and sing loudly through them as if they were the reeds of a grand, mile-high harmonica. Over the centuries, many were the witnesses who thought that whistling, whining winds coming over the narrow ridgetops of Roan Mountain were songs of fairies or ghosts or even of the land itself communing with them. Writer Thomas Wolfe heard his version of this too and listened as the wind howled through the rocking trees with an insane laughter. The broken clouds scudded across the heavens like ghosts in flight. And there are accompanying pictures here. This one says, listen to the wind blow on Grandfather Mountain's mile-high swinging bridge and at the observation tower on the summit of Kuwahi, formerly known as Clingman's Dome, in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And it has a sign of people going, getting ready to go across the swinging bridge. Grandfather Mountain, North Carolina, mile-high swinging bridge, elevation 5,282 feet. Wild Music. Several years ago, I joined a small group of birders intent on giving the swans and snow geese in a cornfield in a slough near Pungo Lake a look and a listen. Easily 3,000 or 4,000 bridal white birds, though golden just then in the more early morning sun, were cackling and laughing at each other, cheering and jeering, everyone a town crier in a village overflowing with avian joy. Pioneering environmentalist Rachel Carson, who worked much around Lake Matamuskeet, celebrated the geese and their wild music, rising at times to a great tumultuous crescendo and dying away again to a throbbing undercurrent, a steady babble of goose voices. And the photo is of geese and swans on Lake Matamuskeet. And, this is Pungo Lake. It says, every winter, birders flock to Pocosin Lake's National Wildlife Refuge to see thousands of tundra swans dotting the surface of Pungo Lake and to hear their whistling cacophony. And there's a couple of the swans in flight. They're enjoying the calm waters of the lake. With bells on, the music of our bells rings out, pealing and deeply chiming or lightly jingling and purling. At churches from Murphy to Elizabeth City, from West Jefferson to Wilmington, bells toll on Sunday morning and calls to worship. On campuses at UNC Chapel Hill and Wake Forest, at Duke and NC State, carillons flood the air victoriously with songs. One note One-note train bells both announce and warn of their approach into our small towns and cities. Other practical one-note wonders, cowbells and goat bells, worn by livestock grazing across the Old North State, have allowed us to follow or find domesticated creatures given to wandering. In my home in our old family hutch is a large 19th century handbell that my great-grandmother Sproul used to call everyone to midday dinner from all across their little alligator riverside farm. As there is meaning in every sound we hear, sometimes I take it out and ring it for myself, just to hear that clang that for hard-working men and women a century and a half ago meant moments of rest, conviviality, sustenance, and in the shade, calm and peace. And has a picture, a drone photo of Duke Chapel, the 50 bells of Duke Chapel's Grand Carillon, including the largest weighing more than 11,000 pounds, have rung out over the university for 90-plus years. More than 10,000 people came to the inaugural concert in 1932. With the bit of time we have left, we're going to switch gears to Our State Supper Club, a new column for the magazine. Slice and share. Decades in kitchens and restaurants have refined one chef's palate, but when the end of the week comes around, nothing beats pizza at home. A pizza crust is a blank canvas for North Carolina flavors like country sausage and pimento peppers. Okay, before we ordered pizzas to our front door, my sisters and I were making them from scratch at home. We'd pull out the Chef Boyardee pizza kit, which included sauce, parmesan, and a mystery blend of flour that transformed into crust when mixed with warm water. My favorite part was spreading the sticky dough onto the pan and pinching off a little to eat while nobody was looking. Once finally in the oven, I knew the pizza was almost ready when I could smell the crust beginning to brown. After high school football games, my friends and I would fill up a table at the back of Bill's Pizza Pub on Battleground Avenue in Greensboro. Established in 1969, Bill's Pizza is still going strong with two locations. As soon as you open the door, the waft of freshly baked dough mixed with sausage and pepperoni hit you all at once. Pizza's cut into squares. The sauce is minimal and slightly sweet, and there's no shortage of toppings. In college, I discovered Pizza Inn. Known for their crispy crust that shatters like a cracker, their options range from loaded supreme to vegetarian to ground beef or sausage with banana peppers. I'd never seen pickled ingredients on a pizza before. Their sweet pizzas topped with fruit opened my eyes to even more possibilities. It's always a treat to have pizza for dinner on Friday night. I'll make a run to Bill's Pizza, or other times I'll make my own, especially if I'm entertaining. I've gotten more adventurous with my creations. I'll pair Fontina cheese with mushrooms and balsamic vinegar, or for a sweet version, figs with goat cheese and honey. While I treasure my memories of Pizza Inn and post-game meals at Bill's, my most memorable pizza nights are always made at home. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving us since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and the broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, please do call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.